Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on a Monday morning, Monday, November the 13th, 2023, 16 minutes past the hour. A chilly morning here in the area, but we are off and running, and you have got a great hour of programming ahead of you this hour. With the holiday season really upon us, Thanksgiving next week, and certainly Christmas right after that, we look for great gifts for people during the holiday season. And there is a new book out, Public Private, My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater. The author is Gail Merrifield Papp, and this is a book you will not want to miss if you have interest in the theater, in creativity, or in the life of people and how something came to be that is very important, I would say, in this country on many, many levels. Joining us this morning for the first hour is the author of this book, Gail Merrifield Papp. Gail, how are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you here. Gail, why did you decide to write the book?
Well, I wanted to bring to life the people, ways, and politics of the public theater that Joe Papp founded in its first 25 years where I worked with him. And I felt there was something in that story, which is partly my personal story, but also an interesting example of how a strong idea for something can really carry you forward with a remarkable enterprise, even if you don't have any money and are starting from, you know, very limited resources. So I thought there was something in that that might speak to people today in the theater, because theaters across the country are at very difficult circumstances these days. And I thought that there was something that might be useful in the example from the past of how Joe and myself in the theater dealt with many issues when it was being founded and growing, that mirror some of the problems that we have today.
Gail, I want to talk about Joe Papp himself. What yeah. kind of guy was he? For people who don't know the name, tell us a little bit about yeah. him.
Well, Joe came from a very humble background in Brooklyn, from an Orthodox Jewish family. He was a poor family. He had no advantages of any kind, but for some interesting reason, he became quite fired up about Shakespeare when he first encountered the speeches in high school, and he loved the sound of the words. So he started to read a great deal, borrowing books from the public library because the family didn't have books at home, and he served in the Navy during World War II. When he got out of the Navy, he enlisted in a theater on the West Coast where he studied acting a little bit. And he wasn't quite sure what he was going to do with this enthusiasm he had for language and also for actors on the stage. He did a little acting, but he didn't really want to do that too much. So in his 30s, he finally got the idea that he wanted to bring Shakespeare free to audiences in New York City's parks. So he began to do that, and the idea kind of caught on. And he managed to persuade various people to help him establish it in Central Park, which is the big main park in New York City. And finally, the city built a theater for him there, an outdoor amphitheater. So he began with this interesting personal enthusiasm for language, the sound of words, and wanting to make the Shakespeare plays accessible, free, to audiences. He had grown up going to parks during the summer to escape the heat, and they were free. So the idea didn't have any deep philosophy at first, but he thought, well, parks are free. Why not do Shakespeare there? So that was like the foundation of his career in the theater. Joe was an extremely articulate person who had a great feeling for people. He loved to empower people in their own selves with what they had to offer. And he had this amazing ability to recognize talent in anybody, no matter where they came from or who they were. So he had a very broad, popular reach in his ambitions that attracted a great many people from all walks of life. That was kind of the foundation of his theater. In future years, when I came on board, I started working in the parks for him, but then that was the very moment that he wanted to do new plays as well as classics. So that was the beginning of the Public Theater, which is a theatrical complex in an historic building in downtown Greenwich Village in New York. And he had no money. It was amazing. He never had any money, but he was able to raise it. And he opened this new theatrical complex, it turned out to be, of several theaters in this lovely old historic building in Greenwich Village for the purpose of doing new American plays and musicals from people who had not been really heard from very much in the theater. So from being a Shakespeare-only organization, all of a sudden, our first show that opened the Public Theater downtown was the original production of Hair. And it was fascinating because we had this interesting juxtaposition of Shakespeare-oriented staff, although it was very small at that time, really about 12 of us. And then all of a sudden, all these hippies and kids during the late 60s when we opened, many of whom were the actors in the original production. So that was how we launched the Public Theater. And Joe had no money to do it, but he was able to raise it. If you don't have any money, you have to raise it, of course. So that was the launch of the Public Theater downtown. But it's the DNA of the theater still to this day comes out of the idea of free tickets for audiences and free access for anybody who has the talent and desire to work in the theater. And that kind of idea has fired up three generations of audiences and actors and playwrights to this day. It's still there.
What was the first production of Hair like at the Public Theater?
Well, it was still in development. You know, they were still writing it, the three wonderful people who wrote the music and the book. And so when we went into rehearsal with it, it was still what you might say in development. They were still writing it from day to day. And it was a little wild. Some of the people in the show had no prior experience in the theater. They'd been cast, actually, from the street by the wonderful, experienced director, Gerald Friedman. And some of them became quite famous later on. But there was a kind of wild, disorganized, and rebellious aspect to the rehearsals that were quite a challenge to Joe to handle. But he managed to do that because he had this ability. Everything was going crazy and wild and disintegrating around him. Joe went after the problems involved, like someone that was like, you know, laying bricks or trying to hammer a nail and a piece of wood. It was very workmanlike and very sensible. So he was able to deal with that. And when we opened, it was the first time that the rock music had really been heard in the theater, believe it or not. Before that, it was a different sound of music in the theater completely. So this was a revolution, and people just went mad, crazy over it. They just couldn't get over the fact they were hearing this kind of sound in the theater, just totally revolutionary. So we had an unexpected hit with our very first show, and it was also the first time since Joe had been doing free Shakespeare in a 2,000-seat amphitheater for several years. Downtown, we had these smaller theaters, and he was selling tickets for the first time. He'd never sold a ticket to anything in his life. So it was an amazing experience to be operating a free theater of considerable size in the park to a somewhat smaller theater downtown where similar lines of people were forming at the box office, but this time to buy tickets rather than to have a free ticket handed to them. It was a very interesting transition.
To have a hit like that right off the bat, how do you think that played into the future of the public theater?
Well, it was very important because, you know, originally what we were downtown was a small, adventurous startup with no resources to speak of, and depending on what we opened with, you know, that was going to be what people's first impression of us was. Joe was not looking for a hit. He was looking for something that he felt excited about. It took him quite a while before he accidentally came across here. He met one of the authors on a train coming back from New Haven, and this gentleman, whose name was Jerome Wagney, handed him a few crumpled pages that were handwritten in pencil of an idea he had for a musical, and Joe took them back to the office with him, and he kind of liked a couple of the ideas and so forth. That's how that started, this very accidental kind of meeting. But Joe had no idea it would be a hit. We didn't know what it was at first. So his openness was a major aspect of what Joe had in the theater, and it reflected the whole organization, ultimately. We were open to all kinds of work from anybody and everybody who had something to say and had the talent to say it. And although that seems like an obvious thing to, you know, conduct business by in the theater these days, it was not the case back then in the 60s. There were a lot of kind of silent obstructions to various kinds of people really working in the theater the way they'd like to. And generally the public theater just opened up the doors. So when that happened, we were just inundated with plays from many, many people who felt they had access. I think the idea of access is really important. And the public theater became identified with that notion. And along with free admission or free access for people who were in the audience, so there was a feeling that the audience, the actors on stage who were cast without regard to ethnicity or anything of that sort being a restriction, and playwrights being able to express themselves in the way they had not been given a platform for before was very powerful. And it still exists at the Public Theater, which calls itself a theater for, by, and of the people. Across the board. So that was a very powerful kind of generative propulsion for a theater that was essentially founded on an idea by someone who had no resources. He had no money, no backing, no donors, nothing when he started out, except passion. And I think more than the passion was that he had kind of a soul of an artist himself, and he expressed himself through what he produced at the theater. And he was not interested in making money. He had to make money. He always was able to scramble and make a living of some sort. But it was a fusion of his artistic purpose, which was just very natural and, thing with him, and his social responsibility. And he felt those were inseparable. He didn't make any distinction between those two things. And it was a very powerful aspect of his leadership of the theater. And I remember I responded to it when I first met him. And he was, I heard him talking about originally free access for people to come into the park and see a play. So gee whiz, everybody here didn't pay for a ticket. That's really amazing. And he compared it to, the free access we all have to books in the public library, for instance. And that comparison really hit home with me, because when I was growing up, my parents never had enough money to buy books at bookstores. We didn't go to bookstores. And the only way I could ever read a book was to borrow it from the public library where I grew up. And so I thought, well, of course, there's this nationwide acceptance that you can get a free book at the library. And that idea of access was very powerful, I felt. And I understood immediately when he talked about it, what it meant and what it meant to me. And I connected very, very strongly with that idea and the way he propelled it forward in a theater. And I thought it was really great. Also, there were a lot of problems back then, this is 1970s, 80s, 90s, that were difficult to deal with. And some of them, I think, really mirror what we have to deal with these days in some ways. And since Joe was a politically adept and shrewd, gifted person, he had different ways of dealing with some of those problems. And I thought, if some of the younger people today might hear about what he did then, it might give them some notion of how they can perhaps adapt some of those ways that he dealt with problems to their own lives and the problems that they're encountering nowadays.
What were some of the big problems in politics that he faced and you faced over those decades?
Well, the very first problem, which sort of became a legend in New York City at least, was the opposition from the city government at first to the idea of free admission to the theater in Central Park. They felt that Joe should charge money for the tickets to defray some of the city's costs in supporting his enterprise. Well, he was willing to raise the money, but he refused to raise it by charging for tickets because he believed in the free admission policy with his whole heart and soul. So that was a major legendary fight he had with a very powerful parks commissioner then named Robert Moses. And it became kind of a David against Goliath sort of contest where Joe was able to marshal enough public opinion to win out finally in the courts. And later on, there was a drift towards intolerance of different kinds of ideas being portrayed on the stage. and also to non-traditional casting, believe it or not. But that was in the 1980s, there was kind of a right drift that resisted certain trends in the theater that had to be dealt with. And it was also aspects of, amongst the problems he had, of censorship from primarily television, because he got into television a little bit. And so I describe these different problems in the book, and then what he did and how he dealt with them. And since he grew up in the Depression era, and I'm at the tail end of the Depression era. I was a baby, but I've heard about it from my parents. So he had certain skills in what he had done during the Depression as a teenager, and growing up in a poor neighborhood in Brooklyn. And he used to take families who were evicted because they couldn't pay the rent, and their furniture would be put on the sidewalk. Then at night, Joe was a teenager, you get some friends together, they put all the furniture back in the apartment where nobody was looking. So he had, and they would organize protests and so forth. So he had this background, came out of the Depression era, of protest and actions to take to fight against something. And he adapted them and applied them later on when he had some of these contests with the city or the newspapers or the television people over certain issues. And he was always very straightforward and adept and action-oriented. He wasn't an ideologue. He was simply action-oriented. When there was an injustice or a wrong, it was in front of his face. And he mobilized people to deal with it. He wasn't always successful. There were some defeats that were very regrettable, but he always mobilized. And I thought there was something in that that was instructive. Certainly was for me. And I thought it might give some people nowadays an idea of what you do when you're confronted with like massive opposition from very powerful sources. And Joe was they called him a fighter. Yes, he was a fighter. But he was also a reflective person. And he was sometimes called a radical, but he was a pragmatic radical. He was always very pragmatic. He wasn't, he didn't like to be called an idealist or a liberal or anything of that sort. He was just, had a wonderful idea of what he wanted to do in this theater, but he was very practical about what he could do and what he did. It was never off the charts. It was very solid, not always successful, but absolutely constant and abiding throughout his entire life. He was a remarkable person. In other words, he was a very special kind of person.
What would you say was the biggest defeat that he had to come back from and did?
Well, let's see. I would say that probably the biggest defeat was early on, when he was prevented from doing free Shakespeare in the parks in New York City, because this very powerful man, Robert Moses, had blocked him from doing his free Shakespeare. Additionally, Joe was defeated by that decision, and he took it to court, and he was also defeated in the court, early court hearings on it. So that could have easily discouraged another person from trying to take anything forward with this idea of doing free performances at a park. But Joe took it another step. He filed another kind of complaint in the court, which went forward. and so that it finally reached the Supreme Court of the State of New York. And that was a five-judge panel that was about to recess. And he managed to get them to hear his complaint to show cause. It's a legal form that I can't really explain too well, but to show cause why he should not be allowed to do Free Shakespeare. He wanted to do Julius Caesar on his temporary platform in Central Park back in the late 50s. So this five-judge panel agreed to hear the show cause complaint finally, and they reviewed the complaint, and they decided unanimously that the park czar, Robert Moses, had been capricious in his decision to prevent this from happening. So Joe won that. Amazingly, at the very last moment, he was able to do the show in park. So I think that was, in the moment that it happened, his defeat initially in the courts was very serious, and he did not have any kind of levers of power in the governmental structure at that time to apply to the problem. He just did it himself. It's just amazing. But he mobilized public opinion. There was a massive public opinion effort on his part to have people write to the newspapers, call in to radio stations, and so forth. That was his strength, I think, that he had the enthusiasm of the public about what he was doing. Mm. They supported him totally. So that was very instructive. It was came out of a huge defeat initially, and that became legendary. A couple of books that wrote an entire chapter to this interesting David versus Goliath, a legend, as it became in New York City. So it was very instructive, and it's a good lesson, I think, an example for anybody these days of what you do when you are facing massive opposition to something you're trying to do that you believe in. And it has public support.
Gail, it's a very interesting theme here, as one we've already touched on, is that he didn't have money.
No.
He wasn't making big money. And yet, he kept on going. In today's world, a lot of people, when choosing their careers, the first thing they say is, "Well, how much is that career going to make? Well, how many jobs are in that field?" Why was this so important when money was not the driving factor?
Well, that's a very good question, because I think money certainly is a driving question these days. I think it always has been, you know, people, you have to make money to earn a living. And Joe was no exception to that. He actually got married very, very early in his life and had families to support. And so when he got out of the Navy, he did get a job on the West Coast with the Actors Lab, but it was not high paying at all. For some reason, although he came out of a very poor background, Joe's main impetus in his life was not to make money. Of course, he needed to make money in order to get by and to support families and so forth. But that was just not the main thing that drove him. He liked to have maybe something better in his life. He enjoyed a good reading lamp or a nice chair. That was fine. But he just never had that desire to just make money. He understood the need to make it. He totally understood the need to raise it for what he was trying to do. But his personal empowerment through money was not something that drove him forward. And although he started with no money for years, he worked on the sidelines as a stage manager in television here in New York City. while he was trying to start up his Shakespeare Enterprise. He had no income from that. And later on, when he had a board of trustees and the public theater was a more established kind of organization, he resisted the suggestions of trustees and the board of trustees that his salary be raised, because he said, well, that just gives me a problem. It means I have to raise more money to pay myself. I don't want to add to that task. So he, if he got stuck without not making enough money to support his family or his personal expenses, he went out and got an extra job on the side somewhere if he was able to weave it in some way. But that was only in the early days. Later on, he didn't need to do that. And he did resist having his salary raised because he didn't want to have to go out and raise the money for it. But eventually he lived very nicely. I still live in an apartment that we shared in Greenwich Village, which is just a few blocks from the public theater. It's a three-room apartment, and I feel very lucky to be living in it. I think he did feel that, too. And we never had any idea of some kind of grander Park Avenue, palatial quarters, or anything of that sort. We lived modestly and felt very fine about that. So other people are driven by a different kind of goal in their life. And Joe is different in that respect. He didn't have an interest in making money for himself. He made no money personally out of any of the hit shows that he ended up producing. If they produced income for the public theater, that's where it went. It went to the public theater and the support of it. It never went to Joe personally. He helped to make millionaires, but he was never a millionaire himself.
Gail, what did being around this man, living with this man, what did it teach you about life? What did you learn from him?
Well, I think mostly I learned some of these examples I've just been talking about. But mostly I learned about the power of a important feeling that one may have about something, and how valuable that is. And it helped me actually to write this book, because I had a very powerful feeling about wanting to write it. It's my first book. I never wrote a book before in my life. And I thought, well, I do have this powerful feeling, and it's maybe has some similarity to how Joe felt about what he was doing in his life. And I remembered how he empowered his own feelings through what he did, and had a reason for doing it. And so that helped me evolve my own attitude towards this book, which, quite frankly, started out just as a personal memoir, a personal story that kind of ran parallel to the, you know, the development of the public theater. But then it became more than that to me. And I think that I learned from Joe's example, and it helped me to carry the book forward in a more expansive way. It was very important to me, actually, and it enlarged its purpose, and at the same time, I accomplished my original desire to reflect something about what I knew of Joe. It's the first personal memoir about him that's been written. There's some other very fine books that have been written about Joe. There's an oral history that's wonderful, and there's a wonderful biography. This is the first personal memoir. And so I thought, well, although I'm not a writer, and I've never written a book before, there's always a first time for anything, especially if you have a very strong feeling and idea about something. So I think I learned that from him and his example. He's also a very generous person, emotionally generous to a remarkable degree, despite the fact that the way the media always portrayed him when he was alive was as, like, arrogant, feisty, you know, those are kinds of adjectives that were used about Joe, because he was viewed as a fighter, a very strong, talking person who was always fighting for something and was combative. That was his public persona. So I thought, well, yeah, I understand that. That was the way he was perceived in some of his battles, but there was this other side to him. It was a different kind of person entirely that I thought perhaps I could reflect to some degree, giving the idea of him and what he stood for a little bit more of a nuanced a portrait than what existed in the press. So I enjoyed doing that very, very much.
For people who have never been to the theater in New York, what yeah. is it about the live theater in New York that is so magical?
Well, of course, New York's famous for Broadway primarily, which is the commercial section of the city where all the major commercial theaters are. That's where people go primarily, but then there's this very large off and off Broadway aspect of theater in New York City, and these are smaller theaters. Some of them are middle-sized theaters. They're all usually non-profit organizations, and so they offer a wide range of different kinds of plays and musicals. And I think theater is a gathering place for people to share an experience. You know, this goes back to ancient history and probably prehistory. They need to gather together. And that's one of the problems that theater is facing right now, because people are somewhat reluctant to gather together in closed spaces still. But I think theater will get around that. They'll find ways to deal with it. But it's essentially a gathering place. And it's a wonderful feeling when you're there sharing an experience with other people. And it brings people together of all kinds. And there's something very moving and important about that when it happens. And I think that's the theater's main attraction. It needs to be reestablished these days because people are reluctant to gather together in closed spaces too much. But I think various theaters will find some way to deal with that. Fortunately, we have an outdoor theater during the summer, so that kind of takes care of that aspect of the post-COVID problem. But the idea of gathering together and sharing an experience is very powerful. It's the same thing that people find in joining an organization, joining a church, a synagogue, whatever. It's the same impulse. You gather together to share something. And that's the fundamental impulse of a theater. It unites the people on the stage, behind the stage, and in the audience. And it's a wonderful thing when you feel that happening amongst people. Or even when you have a division of opinion and there's something that brings you together to try to figure it out and reconcile through a play or a musical. It's a beautiful experience. It's really, really very fine, wonderful experience. Nothing like it when it happens. It doesn't always happen, of course, but when it does, it's just a powerful kind of thing in your life. I felt it many times in my life when, for instance, when we did a play by a famous poet named Intozake Shange. It was called For Colored Girls. And when we did that, even though this play, which was a kind of choreo poem about the girls, black girls' experiences, had nothing to do with my own history of any sort, but I was just knocked out by its power and the beauty of its language and the force of its imagination, just knocked my socks off. And I never recovered from it. It was just so powerful and beautiful. I still find it that way. And so those things are just incomparable. It's like reading a book that you just can hardly believe how wonderful it is. And it stays with you forever. Experiences in theater can be like that also. And so it's a very rich source of having your own experience kind of confirmed and reflected in a variety of ways that enriches your life and it helps you to grow.
Gail, at the end of Joe's life, what was the end like for him, and did he understand the impact that he had had?
Well, I think he understood the impact that he had. And he was very concerned about how the theater would continue without him, because he died too young from unexpected illness. And so he was very concerned about how the theater would continue without him. And I think he felt that there was a certain kind of foundation that had been laid in terms of its direction, mission, and so forth. Finding a successor was difficult, because this is long before a theater would engage a company to try to find somebody. Joe felt it was his own responsibility to find a successor. And but it was a problem, because not everybody who was totally equipped and talented to possibly take his place that he approached wanted to head an institution. Many producers, directors, director-producers, who could have done it, and he approached them. But, you know, being in charge of an institution is a different kind of challenge. Not everybody wants to do that. So it was a difficult problem that he was trying to deal with towards the end of his life. I think he felt that it could go on, but he really didn't know for sure just how it would go on. And he was concerned about the leadership of the theater and the capability of whoever that was going to be to carry it forward, because it is an enormous challenge. There's no question about it. So he understood also that someone that's chosen, say, by a board of trustees, which he would certainly had to get the approval of, is not the founder. You know, a founder person is in a certain kind of relationship to everything. And there's a certain freedom of movement and action that comes with that, which a successor will not have. So he understood those things very, very well. And the succession to Joe after he was gone went through some difficult times. But there were three people who have run the public theater in his capacity since him. The first was Joanne Acolytis, who was a very fine, marvelous director. And then there was George C. Wolfe, a brilliant director playwright, who was at the helm for 10 years of the public theater running it, which was a splendid 10 years of amazing work. And currently, since 2005 is Oscar Eustace, who has been at the helm of as its artistic director, and he's brought amazing talent into the organization. And nourished and fostered Hamilton. And so all of these people, certainly inherited the DNA of the organization from Joe. And basically, and it goes on, it's really interesting how this DNA of Joe's, the origins of a theater through Joe, have gotten passed along, get kind of reinterpreted and developed under different leadership. But it's still there, and it's very, very strong.
Still goes on. Gail, what is the one thing that you want people who read this book to take away from it?
I think to take heart and find encouragement, possibly from an example in the past, and to believe in their own passions and ideas and what they can do with them. It's very difficult for people to feel positive about anything these days, I think. All kinds of people have difficulties. But I think that there's something in the idea of your original inspiration, if you have it, to do something for a good reason, to believe in your ability to carry it forward and attract other people is a very powerful thing. And I hope some people will find encouragement and a reason to feel positive in difficult times.
Absolutely. Again, the book is Public Private, My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater. The author is Gail Merrifield Papp, who we've been chatting with this last hour. What a pleasure it's been, Gail. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to break. We'll be back in about 15 minutes.
The place for guests like Dean of the White House Press.